Cap, Amos interrupted. All due respect, but this ain't Eros. He took a syringe from the med kit and gave the downed man an injection. No radiation rooms, no zombies puking goo. Just that broken box, a whole lot of dead guys and these black threads. We don't know what the fuck it is, but it ain't Eros, and we ain't leaving this guy behind. The small, rational part of Holden's mind knew Amos was right. And more than that, the person Holden wanted to believe he still was would never consider leaving even a complete stranger behind, much less a guy who'd taken a wound for him. He forced himself to take three deep, slow breaths. Prax knelt by Amos's side, holding the medkit. Naomi, Holden said, meaning to apologize for yelling at her. Alex is on the way, she replied, her voice tight but not accusing. He's a few hours out. Running the blockade won't be easy, but he thinks he's got an angle. Where is he putting down? Holden found himself answering before he'd realized he'd made the decision. Tell him to land in the somnambulist berth. I'm giving her to someone. Meet us outside the airlock when we get there. He pulled the mag key for the somnambulist out of a pocket on his harness and tossed it to Wendell. This will get you on the ship you're taking. Consider it a down payment for services rendered. Wendell nodded and tucked the key away, then went back to his injured man. The man appeared to be breathing. Can he be carried? Holden asked Amos, proud of how steady his voice sounded again, trying not to think about the fact that he would have left the man to die a minute before. No choice, Cap. Then somebody pick him up, Holden said. No, not you, Amos. I need you back on point.
I got him, Wendell said. I can't shoot for shit with his hand busted.
Prax, help him, Holden said. We're getting the hell out of here. They moved as quickly as injured people could back through the base, back past the men and women they'd killed getting in and, more frighteningly, the ones they hadn't. Back past Katoa's small, still corpse. Prax's gaze drifted toward the body, but Holden grabbed his jacket and shoved him toward the hatch. It's still not May, he said. Slow us down, and I leave you. The threat made him feel like an ass the moment it left his lips, but it wasn't idle. Finding the scientist's lost little girl had stopped being the priority the instant they found the black filaments, and as long as he was being honest with himself, leaving the scientist behind would mean not being there when they found his daughter, twisted into a monster by the protomolecule, brown goo leaking from orifices she hadn't been born with, the black threads crawling from her mouth and eyes. The older Pinkwater man who'd been covering their exit rushed over to help carry the injured man without being asked. Prax handed the wounded man off to him without a word and then slid in place behind Paula as she scanned the hallways ahead with her machine pistol. Corridors that had seemed boring on the trip in took on a sinister feel on the way back out. The frosted texture that had reminded Holden of spider webs when he'd come in now looked like the veins of some living thing. Their pulsing had to be caused by adrenaline making his eyes twitch. 8 rems burning off Jupiter onto the surface of Ganymede. Even with the magnetosphere, 8 rems a day. How quickly would the protomolecule grow here, with Jupiter endlessly supplying the energy? Eros had become something frighteningly powerful once the protomolecule had taken hold. Something that could accelerate at incredible speeds without inertia. Something that could, if the reports were right, change the very atmosphere and chemical composition of Venus. And that was with just over 1 million human hosts, and 1,000 trillion tons of rocky mass to work with at the beginning. Ganymede had 10 times as many humans, and many orders of magnitude more mass than Eros. What could the ancient alien weapon do with such a bounty? Amos threw open the last hatch to the shadow base, and the crew was back in the higher traffic tunnels of Ganymede. Holden didn't see anyone acting infected. No mindless zombies staggering through the corridors. No brown vomit coating the walls and floor. filled with the alien virus looking for a host. No Protogen hired thug shepherding people into the kill zone. Protogen is gone. An itch at the back of his mind that Holden hadn't even been aware of pushed its way to the front. Protogen was gone. Holden had helped bring them down. He'd been in the room when the architect of the Eros experiment died. The Martian fleet had nuked Phoebe into a thin gas that was sucked into Saturn's massive gravity. Eros had crashed into the acidic and autoclave-hot atmosphere of Venus, where no human ships could go. Holden himself had taken Protogen's only sample of the protomolecule away from them. So who had brought the protomolecule to Ganymede? He'd given the sample to Fred Johnson as leverage to be used in the peace talks. The Outer Planets Alliance had gotten a lot of concessions in the chaos that followed the brief Inner Planets War, but not everything they'd wanted. The Inner Planets fleets in orbit around Ganymede were proof of that. Fred had the only sample of the protomolecule left in the solar system, because Holden had given it to him. It was Fred, he said out loud without realizing it. What was Fred? Naomi asked. This. What's happening here? He did this. No, Naomi said. To drive the inner planets out, to test some kind of super weapon, something. But he did this. No, Naomi said again. We don't know that. The air in the corridor grew smoky, the nauseating scent of burning hair and flesh choking off Holden's reply. Amos held up a hand to halt the group, and the Pinkwater people stopped and took up defensive positions. Amos moved up the corridor to the junction and looked off to his left for several moments. Something bad happened here, he finally said. I've got half a dozen dead. More than that, celebrating. Are they armed? Holden asked. Oh, yeah. The Holden who would have tried to talk his way by them, the Holden who Naomi liked and wanted back, barely put up a struggle when he said, Get us past them. Amos leaned out around the corner and fired off a long burst from his auto shotgun. Go, he said, when the echoes of the gunshots had faded away. The Pinkwater people picked up their wounded and hurried up the corridor and beyond the battle. Prax jogged along close behind, head down and thin arms pumping. Holden followed, a glance showing him dead bodies on fire at the center of a wide hallway. Burning them had to be a message. It wasn't quite bad enough yet for them to be eating each other. Was it? There were a few bodies lying outside the fire, bleeding out on the corrugated metal floors. Holden couldn't tell if they were Amos's handiwork. The old Holden would have asked. The new one didn't. Naomi, he said, wanting to hear her voice. I'm here. We're seeing trouble out here. Is it? He heard the dread in her voice. No, not the protomolecule. But the locals may be bad enough. Seal up the locks, Holden told her, the words coming to him without thought. Warm up the reactor. If something happens to us, leave and rendezvous with Alex. Don't go to Tycho. Jim, she said, I don't go to Tycho. Fred did this. Don't go back to him. No, she said, her new mantra. If we aren't there in half an hour, go. That's an order, XO. At least she would get away, Holden told himself. No matter what happened on Ganymede, at least Naomi would make it out alive. A vision of the nightmare Julie, dead in her shower, but with Naomi's face, flashed in his mind. He didn't expect the little yelp of grief that escaped him. Amos turned and looked back at him, but Holden waved him on without a word. Fred had done this. And if Fred had, then Holden had too. Holden had spent a year playing enforcer to Fred's politician. He'd hunted ships and killed them for Fred's grand OPA government experiment. He'd changed the man he'd been into the man he was now. because some part of him believed in Fred's dream of the liberated and self-governed outer planets. And Fred had secretly been planning this. Holden thought of all the things he'd put off so that he could help Fred build his new solar system order. He'd never taken Naomi to meet his family back on Earth. Not that Naomi herself could ever have gone to Earth, but he could have flown his family up to Luna to meet her. Father Tom would have resisted. He hated travel. But Holden had no doubt that in the end he would have gotten them all to come meet her once he explained how important she'd become to him. And meeting Prax, seeing his need to find his daughter, made Holden realize how badly he wanted to know what that was like. To experience that sort of hunger for the presence of another human being. To present another generation to his parents. To show them that all the effort and energy they had put into him had paid off. That he was passing it along. He wanted, almost more than he'd wanted anything before, to see the looks on their faces when he showed them a child. His child. Naomi's child. Fred had taken that from him. First by wasting his time as the OPA's leg breaker, and now by this betrayal. Holden swore to himself that if he made it off Ganymede, Fred would pay for all of it. Amos halted the group again, and Holden noticed that they were back at the port. He shook himself out of his reverie. He didn't remember how they'd gotten there. "Looks clear," Amos said. "Naomi," Holden said. "What does it look like around the ship?" "Looks clear here," she said. "But Alex is worried that..." Her voice was cut off by an electronic squeal. "Naomi? Naomi!" Holden yelled. But there was no response. To Amos, he said, "Go, double time it to the ship." Amos and the Pinkwater people ran toward the docks as quickly as their injured bodies and unconscious teammate would let them. Holden brought up the rear, shouldering his assault rifle and flicking off the safety as he ran. They ran through the twisting corridors of the port sector, Amos scattering pedestrians with loud shouts and the unspoken threat of his shotgun. An old woman in a hijab scurried away before them like a leaf driven before a storm. She was dead already. If the protomolecule was loose, everyone Holden passed was dead already. Santachai and Melissa Supateaporn, and all the people they'd come to Ganymede to save. The rioters and killers who'd been normal citizens of the station before their social ecosystem collapsed. If the protomolecule was loose, all of them were as good as dead. So why hadn't it happened? Holden pushed the thought aside. Later, if there was a later, he could worry about it. Someone shouted at Amos, and Amos fired his shotgun into the ceiling once. If port security still existed outside of the vultures trying to take a cut of every incoming shipment, they didn't try to stop them. The outer airlock door of the Somnambulist was closed when they reached it. "Naomi, you there?" Holden asked, fumbling in his pockets for the swipe card. She didn't reply, and it took him a moment to remember he'd given the card to Wendell. "Wendell, open the door for us." The Pinkwater leader didn't reply. "Wendell?" Holden started, then stopped when he saw that Wendell was staring wide-eyed at something behind him. Holden turned to look and saw five men, Earthers, all of them, in plain gray armor without insignias. All were armed with large bore weapons. "No," Holden thought, and brought his gun up and across them in a full auto sweep. Three of the five men dropped, their armor blooming red. The new Holden rejoiced. The old was quiet. It didn't matter who these men were. Station security or interplanet military or just leftover mercenaries from the now destroyed shadow base, he'd kill them all before he let them stop him from getting his crew off this infected moon. He never saw who fired the shot that took his leg out from under him. One second he was standing, emptying the magazine of his assault rifle into the gray armored fire team, and the next, a sledgehammer blow hit the armor on his right thigh, knocking him off his feet. As he fell, He saw the two remaining gray armored soldiers go down as Amos's auto shotgun unloaded in a single, long roar. Holden rolled to his side, looking to see if anyone else was hurt, and saw that the five on his side had been only half of the enemy team. The Pinkwater people were raising their hands and dropping their weapons as five more gray-armored soldiers came down the corridor from behind. Amos never saw them. He dropped the expended magazine from his auto shotgun and was pulling a new one off his harness when one of the mercenaries aimed a large weapon at the back of his head and pulled the trigger. Amos's helmet flew off, and he was slapped forward onto the corrugated metal decking with a wet crunch. Blood splashed across the floor where he hit it. Holden tried to get a new magazine into his assault rifle, but his hands wouldn't cooperate, and before he could reload his gun, one of the soldiers had crossed the distance and kicked the rifle away from him. Holden had time to see the still-standing members of his Pinkwater team disappear into black bags before one came down over his own head and plunged him into darkness. Chapter 20. Bobby. The Martian delegation had been given a suite of offices in the UN building for their own use. The furniture was all real wood. The paintings on the walls were originals and not prints. The carpet smelled new. Bobby thought that either everyone in the UN campus lived like a king, or they were just going out of their way to impress the Martians. Thorson had called her a few hours after she'd left her run-in with Avasarala at the bar, and had demanded that she meet with him the next day. Now she waited in the lobby of their temporary office suite, sitting in a bergère-style chair with green velvet cushions and a cherry wood frame that would have cost her 2 years' salary on Mars. A screen set into the wall across from her played a news channel with the sound muted. It turned the program into a confusing and occasionally macabre slideshow of images. Two talking heads sitting at a desk in a blue room. A large building on fire. A woman walking down a long white hallway while gesturing animatedly to both sides. A UN battleship parked at an orbital station with severe damage scarring its flank. A red-faced man talking directly into the camera against the backdrop of a flag Bobby didn't recognize. It all meant something and nothing at the same time. A few hours before, this would have frustrated Bobby. She would have felt compelled to go find the remote and turn the sound up to add context to the information being thrown at her. Now, she just let the images flow around her like canal water past a rock. A young man she'd seen a few times on the Daejeon, but had never actually met, hurried through the lobby, tapping furiously on his terminal. When he was halfway across the room, he said, "He's ready for you." It took Bobby a moment to realize the young man had been talking to her. Apparently, her stock had fallen far enough that she no longer warranted face-to-face delivery of information. More meaningless data. More water flowing past her. She pushed herself to her feet with a grunt. Her hours-long walk at 1G the previous day had taken more out of her than she'd realized. She was vaguely surprised to find that Thorson's office was one of the smallest in the suite. That meant that either he didn't care about the unspoken status conferred through office size, or he was actually the least important member of the delegation to still rate a private workspace. She felt no compulsion to figure out which. Thorson did not react to her arrival, his head bent over his desk terminal. Bobby didn't care about being ignored or about the lesson he was trying to teach her with it. The size of the office meant that Thorson had no chair for guests, and the ache in her legs was sufficiently distracting. "I may have overreacted earlier," he finally said. "Oh?" Bobby replied, thinking about where she might find more of that soy milk tea. Thorson looked up at her. His face was trying its mummified remains version of a warm smile. "Let me be clear. There's no doubt that you damaged our credibility with your outburst, But, as Martins points out, that is largely my fault for not fully understanding the extent of your trauma.
Ah, Bobby said.
There was a framed photograph on the wall behind Thorson of a city with a tall metal structure in the foreground. It looked like an archaic rocket gantry. The caption read, Paris.
So, instead of sending you home, I will be keeping you on staff here. You'll be given an opportunity to repair the damage you've done.
Why, Bobby said, looking Thorson in the eye for the first time since coming in, am I here? Thorson's hint of a smile disappeared and was replaced by an equally understated frown.
Excuse me?
Why am I here? She repeated, thinking past the disciplinary board, thinking of how hard it would be to get reassigned to Ganymede if Thorson didn't send her back to Mars. If he didn't, would she be allowed to resign? Just leave the Corps and buy her own ticket? The thought of no longer being a Marine made her sad, the first really strong feeling she'd had in a while.
Why are you... Thorson started, but Bobby cut him off.
Not to talk about the monster, apparently. Honestly, if I'm just here as a showpiece, I think I'd rather be sent home. I have some things I could be doing.
You, Thorson said, his voice getting tighter, are here to do exactly what I say for you to do, and exactly when I say it. Is that understood, soldier?
Yeah, Bobby said, feeling the water slide past her. She was a stone. It moved her not at all. I have to go now. She turned and walked away, Thorson not managing to get a last word out before she left. As she moved through the suite toward the exit, she saw Martins pouring powdered creamer into a cup of coffee in the small kitchen area. He spotted her at the same time.
Bobby, he said. He'd gotten a lot more familiar with her over the last few days. Normally, she'd have assumed it was a build-up to romantic or sexual overtures. With Martins, she was pretty sure it was just another tool in his how-to-fix-broken Marines toolkit.
Captain, she said. She stopped. She felt the front door tugging at her with a sort of psychic gravity, but Martins had never been anything but good to her. And she had a strange premonition that she was never going to see any of these people again. She held out her hand to him, and when he took it, she said, I'm leaving. You won't have to waste your time with me anymore. He smiled his sad smile at her.
In spite of the fact that I don't actually feel like I've accomplished anything, I don't feel like I wasted my time.
Do we part friends?
She started, then had to stop and swallow a lump in her throat.
I hope this didn't wreck your career or anything.
I'm not worried about it, he said to her back.
She was already walking out the door. She didn't turn around. In the hallway, Bobby pulled out her terminal and called the number Avasarala had given her. It immediately went to voicemail.
Okay, she said. I'll take that job.
There was something liberating and terrifying about the first day on a new job. In any new assignment, Bobby had always had the unsettling feeling that she was in over her head, that she wouldn't know how to do any of the things they would ask her to do, that she would dress wrong or say the wrong thing, or that everyone would hate her. But no matter how strong that feeling was, it was overshadowed by the sense that with a new job came the chance to totally recreate herself in whatever image she chose. That, at least for a little while, her options were infinite. Even waiting for Avasarala finally to notice her couldn't fully dampen that feeling. Standing in Avasarala's office reinforced Bobby's impression that the Martian suite was intended to impress. The deputy secretary was important enough to get Bobby transferred out of Thorson's command and into a liaison role for the UN with a single phone call. And yet, Her office had cheap carpet that smelled unpleasantly of stale tobacco smoke. Her desk was old and scuffed. No cherry wood chairs here. The only things that looked lovingly tended in the room were the fresh flowers and the Buddha shrine. Avasarala radiated weariness. There were dark circles under her eyes that hadn't been there during their official meetings and hadn't been visible in the dim lights of the bar where she'd made her offer. Sitting behind her giant desk in a bright blue sari, she looked very small, like a child pretending to be a grown-up. Only the gray hair and crow's feet ruined the illusion. Bobby suddenly pictured her instead as a cranky doll, complaining as children moved her arms and legs and forced her to go to tea parties with stuffed animals. The thought made her cheeks ache from restraining the grin. Avasarala tapped at a terminal on her desk and grunted with irritation. "No more tea for you, Grandma Dolly. You've had enough," Bobby thought, then stifled a laugh. "Sorin, you've moved my fucking files again. I can't find a goddamn thing anymore." The stiff young man who'd brought Bobby into the office and then sort of melted into the background cleared his throat. It made Bobby jump. He was closer behind her than she'd realized. "Ma'am, you asked me to move a few of the..." "Yes, yes," Avasarala interrupted, tapping harder on the terminal screen as if that would make the device understand what she wanted. Something about that made Bobby think of people who started talking louder when trying to communicate with someone who spoke a different language. "Okay, there they are," Avasarala said with irritation. "Why you'd put them..." She tapped a few more times, and Bobby's terminal chimed. "That," she said, "is the report and all of my notes on the Ganymede situation. Read them today. I may have an update later once I've had a little polite questioning done." Bobby pulled out her terminal and scrolled quickly through the document she'd just been sent. It went on and on for hundreds of pages. Her first thought was, did she really mean read all of this today? This was quickly followed by, did she really just hand me everything she knows? It made her own government's recent treatment of her look even worse. "It won't take you long," her new boss continued. "There's almost nothing there. Lots of bullshit by overpaid consultants who think they can hide the fact that they don't actually know anything by talking twice as long." Bobby nodded, but the feeling of being in over her head had started to outcompete her excitement at a new opportunity. "Ma'am, is Sergeant Draper cleared to access?" Sorin said. "Yes, I just cleared her. Bobby, you're cleared," Avasarala said right over the top of him. "Stop busting my balls, Sorin. I'm out of tea." Bobby made a conscious effort not to turn around and look at Sorin. The situation was uncomfortable enough without driving home the fact that he'd just been humiliated in front of a foreigner with exactly 17 minutes on the job. "Yes, ma'am," Sorin said. "But I was wondering whether you should alert the security service about your decision to clear the sergeant. They do like to be in the loop on that kind of thing." "Meow, meow, cry, meow, meow," Avasarala said. "That's all I heard you say." "Yes, ma'am," Sorin said. Bobby finally looked back and forth between them. Sorin was being dressed down in front of a new team member who was also, technically, the enemy. His expression hadn't changed. He looked like he was humoring a demented grandmother. Avasarala made an impatient clicking sound with her teeth. "Was I not clear? Have I lost the ability to speak?" "No, ma'am," Sorin said. "Bobby, can you understand me?"
Yes, sir."
"Good. Then get out of my office and do your jobs. Bobby, read, Sorin, tea." Bobby turned to leave and found Sorin staring at her, his face expressionless, which was, in its way, more disconcerting than a little well-justified anger would have been. As she walked past him, Avasarala said, "Sorin, wait. Take this to Foster and Data Services." She handed Sorin what looked like a memory stick. "Make sure you get it to him before he leaves for the day." Soren nodded, smiled, and took the small black wafer from her.
Of course.
When he and Bobby had left Avasarala's office and Soren had closed the door behind them, Bobby let out a long, whistling exhale and smiled at him.
Wow, that was awkward.
Sorry about... she started, but stopped when Soren held up his hand, casually dismissing her concern.
It's nothing, he said. She's actually having a pretty good day.
While she stood gaping and looking at him, Soren turned away from her and tossed the memory stick onto his desk, where it slid under the wrapper of a half-eaten package of cookies. He sat down and put on a headset, then began scrolling through a list of phone numbers on his desktop terminal. If he noticed her continued presence, he gave no sign.
You know, Bobby said finally, I just have some stuff to read, so if you're busy, I could take that thing to the data services guy. I mean, if you're busy with other stuff.
Soren finally looked at her quizzically.
Why would I need you to do that?
Well, Bobby said, glancing at the time on her terminal, it's pretty close to 1800 local, and I don't know what time you guys usually close up shop, so I just thought,
don't worry about it. The thing is, my whole job is making her,
he jerked his head toward the closed door,
calm and happy. With her, everything's top priority. And so nothing is, you know? I'll do it when it needs doing. Until then, the bitch can bark a little if it makes her feel happy.
Bobby felt a cool rush of surprise. No, not surprise. Shock.
You just called her a bitch?
What would you call her, right? Soren said with a disarming grin. Or was it mocking? Was this all a joke to him? Avasarala and Bobby, and the monster on Ganymede, too. An image popped into her head of snatching the smug little assistant out of his chair and snapping him into a zigzag shape. Her hands flexed involuntarily. Instead, she said, Madam Secretary seemed to think it was pretty important.
Soren turned to look at her again. Don't worry about it, Bobby. Seriously, I know how to do my job.
She stood for a long moment.
Solid copy on that, she said.
Bobby was yanked from a dead sleep by sudden, blaring music. She lurched upright in an unfamiliar bed in a nearly pitch-black room. The only light she could see was a faint, pulsing, pearly glow from her hand terminal all the way across the room. The music suddenly stopped sounding like an atonal cacophony and became the song she'd selected as the audio alarm for incoming phone calls when she went to bed. Someone was calling. She cursed them in three languages and tried to crawl across the bed toward the terminal. The edge of the bed came unexpectedly and plunged her face first toward the floor, her half-asleep body not compensating for Earth's heavier gravity. She managed to avoid breaking her head open at the cost of a pair of jammed fingers on her right hand. Cursing even louder, she continued her trek across the floor to the still glowing terminal. When she finally reached it, she opened the connection and said, "If someone isn't dead, someone will be." "Bobby," the person on the other end said. It took Bobby's fuzzy head a moment to place the voice. "Soren." She glanced at the time on her terminal and saw that it was 0411. She wondered if he was calling to drunkenly upbraid her or apologize.